maybe you could pin by 2:30.
Oh, yes, yes. Yeah. Well, this is a third oral history with Elkin Blout on the 22nd of November, 2002. Let me just... Elkin, can you begin by telling me some more about Polaroid?
Yes, I've been thinking a lot about it, as you know, in the last couple of years, especially in the last year since it's, quotes, going down the tube, close quotes. I'd like to tell you about my life there. As you know, I started as a chemist, and then I worked on the color photography. In fact, when my main job there was translating the idea of the instant color photograph into reality. It was a very exciting time, and it was very exciting to work at Polaroid with Ben Land, even though we didn't have an awful lot of intimate day-to-day activity. But he was very interested in the idea of color, instant color photography succeeding. So it was really nothing I asked him that he didn't agree to. And as you might know, we ended up with a large group of chemists at Polaroid who worked on the color photography process and also worked with certain aspects of the Kodak organization on this process. But one of the most interesting things about my life at Polaroid was whether I got satisfaction out of it. And the answer is I did get great satisfaction out of it, but not complete satisfaction. And I think the reason for the not complete satisfaction was that Ben Land, while being very supportive, was also very secretive. He believed in keeping things as secret as possible. And this is the antithesis of many aspects of the academic world, and is the thing that eventually led me to going back to the academic world. Din was a imaginative, charismatic leader when he wanted to be. He was also a son of a bitch when he wanted to be.
In what sort of way?
Well, he was very demanding and very imperial in certain ways. And I guess that is what's necessary in some organizations for it to succeed. It isn't necessary in the academic world, but it is necessary in some other organizations. But I must say, I really liked Din, even though I had my differences with him. I liked him because he was smart enough to let me do what I want and encourage me in doing it. He was very self-righteous in what he did and wanted to get credit for everything he did. In fact, one of the difficulties of being at Polaroid is that he wanted credit for most of the things that everybody did. And this created tensions in the organization. Certain people left, other people stayed and fumed about that. One of one of the good people who left was Stan Calderwood, who just died within the last month or so and left Polaroid as a result of disagreements with Dan, and ended up being a very successful financial entrepreneur in the Boston area, made a hell of a lot of money, and gave a good deal of it to the Museum of Fine Arts.
What was his role at Polaroid?
At Polaroid, he was responsible for publicity, public relations. And he was very smart at that and very good at that. He left Polaroid because he didn't like the way Dim did things, that he demanded things of lots of people, and he decided that he would either have to be the president of Polaroid or leave, and since he wasn't going to be the president, he left.
Can you talk about Polaroid after you left it and the more recent career of Polaroid?
As you know, I left Polaroid when I went to Harvard in about 1961, although I was a consultant for the succeeding 25 years. And my best relationship was not really with Dan, but was with William McCune, who succeeded Dan as the president and CEO of Polaroid. Bill McCune is still alive. In fact, he and I try to see each other once a week or once every 2 weeks. And we're two of the few people who remember Polaroid as it was. He, like me, was admiring of Dan, but had his difficulties. Dan's ego was great. He wanted to be recognized for what he did. And in his latter part of his life, he was not so much interested in Polaroid, but interested in the idea of working out the physics, as he calls it, of television. And he had some original ideas. However, they were not generally accepted, so he didn't find it very happy in the last 10 years of his life. I don't think Polaroid fostered many new organizations, except those that did want to foster. And those were usually very personal. He wanted to foster the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He became president in the 1950s, and he tried to change the Academy in very subtle ways, and by giving them a major gift, which resulted in the new building. He wanted the Academy to be more useful to society, as I do, but neither he nor I could succeed in this. I think it's the aim of many people, but it hasn't. Nobody has really succeeded. The Polaroid life, as I knew it, was interesting, was challenging, and was financially rewarding.
Well, with 2020 hindsight, where do you think Polaroid, quote unquote, went wrong?
Polaroid went wrong by 11, thin land, dominate business decisions. He used his personal quotes, scientific insight, close quotes, to lead the company. His original insights into the polarizer, plastic polarizer, and to instant photography were excellent and resulted in Polaroid being a great company. But his later insights into instant movies and into other aspects that Polaroid invested in were wrong and were eventually Din's downfall. Din eventually had to fight Bill McCune, who became the succeeding CEO and president, and it was very unpleasant for Din to do that, and unpleasant for Bill McCune to do it, but that was necessary in order to mitigate Din's influence. It's a sad story in the final part of it.
Was McCune essentially was never able to get an independent, viable, new research center. Is that
That's
one
correct.
Way of saying
That's
it?
Correct. He tried. He and I tried, for example, to apply some of the techniques of Polaroid to medical analysis. We did do it. We developed an instrument in conjunction with another organization, but it was successful, but not a big success. Bill also tried to make Polaroid mimic Kodak in that it would pay attention to the quality of its products. This was a difficult fight, but Bill was the person who really led that fight. Unfortunately, he didn't succeed in doing what he thought he should do, namely developing new photographic systems which would answer some of the objections to the present Polaroid instant photography. Bill tried to do this, but the organization didn't accept his trying to do it, and so he was constantly unhappy that that occurred. And as you know, the present situation of Polaroid is that we have a shell of an organization with nothing really there. I'm very fortunate that I was at Polaroid during the heyday, and that I got out at a time where I didn't have to suffer some of the emotional problems that other people had in the latter days of the company.
Yes. You may not have known it at the time, but you're a master of timing.
I didn't know it, but I was lucky. I've been lucky in lots of things in my life. I keep thinking about it now I think better, especially the last few months as I grow older. Mm-hmm.
Can we, should we turn to some family things?
I don't know whether it's been clear, but I married my boyhood sweetheart, who was Joan Dreyfus. I married her. We married within a few months as I graduated from Princeton.
She was a New Yorker.
She was a transcribed New Yorker. She was born in Montgomery, Alabama, but her father was a salesman, and he worked out of New York, and she lived in New York. And I had met her actually on the street in New York, and we were interested enough so that when Ed Dreyfus suggested as a graduate student that if he would continue Jones' fairly generous allowance while I was a graduate student, it really shaped my life, and I was grateful to him for that. He and Jones' father and I had sympathy and empathy, and that resulted in my advising him on some of his financial situation, some of his charitable situation.
Was this much later, or was this when you were...
This was when I had left, after I had left Polaroid, but we were close together.
What year did you marry him?
Married in 1939.
And at that moment you were reminding me...
I was a graduate student in Columbia.
Yes. And Joan...
She was at Skidmore College. That we were married.
And then did she become a full-time housewife?
Yes, she doesn't admit it, but she did become a full-time housewife and mother. We had three wonderful children in the 1960s, both of whom were born in the Boston area, actually at Boston I&M Hospital.
What were your children's names?
My oldest boy is named Jim James. My oldest girl is named Susan. And my youngest boy is named William.
Do you recall their birth dates?
Oh, yes. Often? Jim was born on February 22nd, 1943, and Susan was born 2 years later, and Jim 2 years later.
Mm-hmm. And what are they doing now?
They're all, the two boys are living in the Boston area. And the girl is living in the Chicago area. The boys have suffered from the problem of having too much money. And although they tried to be successful as individuals, they've only succeeded in relation to the family, not in the real world. I was, during this period, when the boys were growing up, I was not home much because I was working practically 12 or 18 hours a day and working on two jobs, both the Polaroid job and the Harvard job, the initial Harvard job. I lost some of my adulthood because of my work when I've gained life is clear other things. I guess that is why you don't win every way. Anyway, my three oldest children are now divorced and remarried, or two of them remarried, and they're struggling still. I think it's a real struggle for children to be children, part of a successful father's family. And I know it all the time now. Finally...
Plus the 50s, which was very crucial decade for them, was when you were working hardest and also enjoying kind of the greatest differential coefficient of success.
That's right. And I'm beginning to enter a new life. Yeah. I made the decision to leave Polaroid when I was 40 years of age and was financially self-sufficient. And I think they suffered during that period. Around the end of that time, we had acquired property on Cuttyhunk, and we had acquired a boat. The boat was a main fishing boat, which was actually it was a lobstering boat, which was very practical, and that is how I learned to be a boatsman. It's interesting with the boat that my youngest son suggested we name it Nomad, and that was because I used to get mad so often at the frustrations relating to the family. And so my first boat was named Nomad, and subsequent boats were named Peptide. And those were boats that I enjoyed and used completely as enjoyment.
How did Joan respond to the success and the change in circumstance?
If I look at it honestly, I think she was jealous. She could never quite accept the fact that I was succeeding without her. She wanted to be recognized for her part in life, and she never really succeeded in that. Joan and I were divorced in 1984, but we maintained a difficult relation. She now lives in the same apartment I live in. Not in the same apartment itself, but in the same apartment building. And the reason is that I didn't want to move from this building, and neither did she. We were both stubborn about it. So she and I have separate apartments in this building.
39 to 84 is a long time. Were you effectively separated?
We were separated in 1978, I remember it well. She helped me move out of our apartment to us. I rented an apartment in the building, and she helped me move. And that was the beginning of the end.
Did you, how long before did you know this was coming?
Well, we separated in 1978. We were divorced in 1984. It took us quite a while.
But before 78?
Oh, it was clear that I was unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
I had a couple of other friends, female friends, during that period, and that didn't help our relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Just say, though, when John and I were divorced finally, and I ultimately asked D.L. Ferris to marry me, it started a new part of my life. And Gail and I have been very different and very happy in our relationship. And it's been magnified by the fact that although we couldn't have a child by that marriage, we did feel so strongly about each other that we decided to adopt a child. And we looked around the world to try and find a young girl. That is what, that was our criterion for an adopted child. And we couldn't find the satisfactory young girl in the United States. So we talked about it and we decided that we liked the Russian people enough that we try and find a Russian girl. And we did find a girl in Uzbekistan, and we adopted her 10 years ago, and she's been a great pleasure in our life. She's
her name is?
Daria. Her name is Daria. He kept the Russian name, and she knows she was adopted. She also knows, ultimately, now, that we searched the world really to find her, and we were very happy we found this girl.
How old was she when?
She was 6 months old,
mm-hmm.
and she was in an orphanage in Kazakhstan.
Mm-hmm. And that was what year?
10 years ago. So. 1992.
Tell me a little bit more about Gail. When were you married?
We were married in 1984. She was actually my assistant, my father, so we knew each other well. She comes from a large family. Siblings, whereas I was an only child, so it was an interesting and good marriage, and still is such. Gail is a very understanding, intelligent, and caring person, and I consider myself extremely lucky.
Again, with 20/20 hindsight, looking back to those young days, and if you were living them again from this relationship point of view, do you think it's, what I guess what I want to say is, was it inevitable that what happened?
I think so. In fact, I've talked about this with several people, including my oldest children. And they couldn't understand why we didn't get divorced earlier in our life. But not to have gotten divorced earlier. Joe knew that. And that gave, when she remarried me, that gave me the impetus to remarry myself.
Well, there's been a huge change in social assumptions in the background, of course.
Right, it's always times of change. She liked, John liked, many of the things I as a person were able to provide to her. And she still considers herself very friendly and loving to me, which is sort of crazy. I said, I had other aspects of my life during this period, one of which was fishing. I became very interested in deep sea fishing and had two fishing boats, and in fact, went into a few fishing tournaments to try and boat large fish, hopefully swordfish. I had them on the line, but one of the disappointments of my life is that I never was able to put one in the boat by rod and reel. We didn't. We wanted to do the sportsman-like way rather than sticking them with a harpoon. We never got one into the boat with rod and reel.
How did you get... How did that world ever come to your attention?
That started out because when John and I lived in Cambridge, we had a neighbor named Eunice Sawyer. Eunice was about our age, and she had been born in Fairhaven, and she, her fantasy was to have a small, was to have a house on a small island called Cuttyhunk, which is about 12 miles from Fairhaven, sticking out in the ocean. And she actually, when the end of the First World War occurred, she, with her then husband, put together $5,000 to build, to buy the land and build this house.
Was this in Maine? Or
well, on the island of Cuttyhunk.
Yeah, off the coast of?
Off the coast of New Bedford. Okay. It's off the coast of New Bedford. In fact, Cuttyhunk is the last of the Elizabeth Islands. And so and beyond Cuttyhunk, you go to the ocean. Anyhow, we originally rented from Eunice, and then when she had financial difficulties, we bought the house, and then expanded the house during this period, bought new land on Cuttyhunk, and established a different life on this island.
This is an island with how many people on it?
25 to 30 during the winter, and about 200 to 300 during the summer. Actually, it has its own government, a town meeting kind of government, and Gail is now a selectman on the island and goes to the island twice a month to the selectman meeting. So we still have a very close relationship.
There's a ferry.
There's a ferry from New Bedford. There are people who travel in fishing boats, and recently there's been an airplane coming from New Bedford Airport, which can land both at the airport and has pontoons that allows it to land in Cuttyhunk Harbor. So there's transportation, but it's not easy transportation.
So you started going there
in 1950.
For summer only. Well, you were at Polaroid then, so right. You didn't have long.
No, I had a week or so.
When you were in your Harvard phase, did you go there for longer periods of time or not?
Theoretically, I wanted to. In fact, when I was in my Harvard phase, I had the fantasy that I could live 3 months in Cambridge, live 3 months in Key Biscayne, where by then we had a house, live 3 months in France, where we also had a house, and spend 3 months at Cuttingham. So we lived in 4 3-month periods. This was fantasy, but it was my fantasy at the time.
At what age were you when you said, this is my desire?
I was just turning 60.
And in that statement, was it, this is my desire at 65?
60.
Or at 60?
Yeah, just... But,
So did you do it for 1 year? Did you ever get on the program?
Never. I never. The closest we came to is when I was married to Joan, we spent about 2.5 months one winter at Cuttingham. Mm-hmm. That was pleasant in many ways, but difficult in other ways.
How old were you by that moment?
At that time, I was about 65,
60. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I was going to say, one aspect, I'm listening to Confessions of a Workaholic.
That's right. That's right. I found it very hard. I didn't realize I was such a workaholic until I was older. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, I'm not happy unless I work. Mm-hmm. And I find reasons to work during my first marriage, and even now.
Mm-hmm. What do you, just going right to now, and given that desire, what is number one, what is your typical week? Do you take, are the days that you really take off, or are old days?
Yes, on our old age, since I met Gail and I have married, we recognize that while we love Cuttingham as a vacation paradise, that it isn't practical to have an island be the aim of your vacation. So we look for property closer to Cambridge, which we could use as a vacation home. And 15 years ago, we found some property in a town called Marion, and we were wealthy enough that we could afford to build a house. We now use this house, the Marion house, for weekend vacations. So generally we spend 5 days a week in Cambridge and 2 days a week.
And that's the normal pattern.
That's that normal pattern. In the last 2 years, I've gotten older, and we've spent, not only had that pattern, but we stayed at Cuttingham for between 6 weeks to 10 weeks a year.
So on the 5 days a week that you're here, describe a typical day, as it were.
Well, it's really...
There isn't one, I know.
It's not a typical, but it is talking to people, working with people, getting new ideas. One of the things I haven't talked to you about is the fact that I spent about 8 years working for the Food and Drug Administration. This came about when I was still at Harvard, and I think I ought to emphasize that many of the things in my life, many of the good things, happened by chance. One of these was my beginning of my association to the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration. And that came about because a colleague of mine at Harvard, Paul, forget the last name, was friendly with the new commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, David Kessler, who had been a student at Harvard Medical School. And he then asked Paul whether he would come to the Food and Drug Administration as his scientific person. Paul was a surgeon at Mass General Hospital and didn't want to do that, but he said to David Kessler, "Let me suggest somebody who I think might be interested in." And it was I, Elkin Blout, that Paul suggested. And that I then went to Washington, like David Kessler, and we hit it off, and I became his senior advisor for science the entire time he was commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. That was an interesting 8 years. David wanted me to spend full time in Washington, but I told him I thought I could do the job without being full time. In fact, I didn't want to spend full time. So he agreed, and I used to travel every week for a day or two or three or four or five from Cambridge to Washington to do my job at the FDA. And you could ask, what did I do at the FDA? Well, I'll say first that I did not approve medicines or approve medical products, but what I did do was work with the senior scientists of FDA and tried to make them more content in their jobs and more useful in their jobs. And I set up two FDA boards, one the Senior Science Council and one the Younger Science Council, which lasted all during my tenure and lasted beyond it.
And these were all of people at FDA.
Yeah, right. I worked with them. And what I did was actually not get an apartment in Washington, but just ask the Watergate if they would reserve a room for me when I came, and they did. So I spent that period at the Watergate Hotel rather than in the apartment.
Well, those science councils, those were to encourage people to talk with one another?
Talk with one another and to do new things with each other. And they were quite successful. I still have some of the plaques from those people, which you can see on the walls of my study. Some of the signatures of people I worked with. It was quite a rewarding time for me because although I had been in Washington as the treasurer of the National Academy of Sciences, I had never worked for the government. And I was working for the government when I was at FDA. so I knew some of the satisfactions of working for the government and some of them. Some of the problems.
The satisfactions being?
Well, that you, satisfactions was you felt you were at the crux of activity. And in fact, the Food and Drug Administration actually testifies to about 30% of all the country's products. So it was a very challenging period. I enjoyed, David Kessler and I really enjoyed each other. In fact, he knows this, I was the person who suggested him for his present job, which is dean at Yale Medical School. Mm-hmm.
The frustrations were
not being able to have enough money to attract the very top scientific people. Mm-hmm. We could not do that, but we did have a few good people, but not the very top people. Mm-hmm. As a result, the Food and Drug Administration was more a licensing organization rather than a creative organization. I tried to make it more creative, but I was not successful.
Yeah. If we come back into family, you've mentioned the fishing, the deep sea fishing, the boating. I mean, that all that takes time. So you did get some time out.
Oh yes, I did have days, 2 days, 3 days, which I could take off, in which I would, in the early days, learn to fish with my children, and later days learn to boat, and that included Bob Woodward. He used to enjoy an occasional day or two on the boat. In fact, he and I both ran one of the peptides from Cuddy Hunt to Bridgehampton, where his wife Eudoxia lived during their marriage, and he was challenged by trying to run a boat as I was. So that was one of the things that made us close too.
Was it? Were there just the two of you? I mean, how many people did it take to run the boat?
Two could do it, but really three. It was about a 58-foot boat, so we had to have more than one.
Mm-hmm. So who did you most often be sailing with?
I most often sailed with my brother-in-law. I haven't mentioned him. I mentioned one of them, who was Joan's brother, Jack Dreyfus, but my other brother-in-law was Joan's sister's husband. He was Dick Reese, and Dick was a classmate and roommate of mine at Princeton, and he and I were very close, mm-hmm. and friendly. We spent a lot of time together. In fact, we see each other now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He's been in our world a little bit.
Right, he was.
On the Other hobbies and diversions. You mentioned gardening.
I guess since I was a born and bred New Yorker, I was attracted to the land, and part of it was living at Cuttinghut, part of it was living in France, part of it was our condominium at Key Biscayne, but I always liked gardening, and I love growing things, and while Gail and I were married and living in Belmont, I built a greenhouse which allowed me to relax.
Are you saying Joan?
Yes, Joan, originally. Built a greenhouse in Belmont. Then Joan and I moved from Belmont to 1010 Memorial Drive.
When was that? Was that after the children had grown?
Oh, yes, it was after the children had grown. It was at the instigation of Bob Woodward, because he was living here as a renter, and he knew the building was being turned from a rental property into a condominium to a cooperative property. And he convinced me to buy a couple of apartments at 1010 in that period, I would say 1953, thereabouts. And I intended to live here at 1010. We then modified the apartments, including putting in a greenhouse, an internal greenhouse, for me and a special tub and bathroom for Joan. So we used our money during that period trying to be happy, but we never succeeded.
So, you still got a garden at your country?
I still have a greenhouse at my country. And in fact, now I started to grow orchids in my greenhouse at Marion and became fascinated by it. And now continue to grow them here at 1010 and at Marion. That was the second relaxation for me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all work, although it was a lot of work. It wasn't all work. And I did have the wherewithal to build greenhouse, to buy orchids, and to endow other things, which I will tell you about in my life. As I look back on it, I consider myself very lucky and in many ways very fortunate. I didn't live a perfect life, but I did live an interesting life and a challenging life.
We're doing fine. We're doing fine.
Yes. Yes. Uh-huh. You haven't, incidentally, I haven't heard, just let me check,
opera, ballet, orchestra, parties.
I didn't want to. During my marriage, to, I was working very hard originally at Polaroid, then at Children's Hospital, then at Harvard. And I didn't have much time to do anything but work. I guess if I wanted to, I could, but I didn't, and I don't now. My life is enjoying working, I would say. And that's really been a challenge. It's been a challenge in that I've had these different aspects of my life, starting with Polaroid, then going to Harvard, then going to the National Academy of Sciences, then going to the Food and Drug Administration. So I've had lots of challenges and different challenges. And I've met lots of people. I've known lots of interesting people, some of whom I've mentioned, but also I've known not only interesting colleagues, but interesting female companions during my life. One of the things I've wanted to do is to give back to society some of the things I've gotten.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. I feel lucky in that I've been able to make enough money so I could do most of the things I wanted to do, and enough money to be divorced and still be a financially capable we've all read in the paper about public divorces such as that which Jack Welch, the former president of General Electric, is going through, and we can imagine how difficult it is. And this was true with me, but to me, my object in life is not making more money, but my object in my last 20 or 25 years is giving back to society, some of which I have gained through my life. I spend now a good part of my time working with groups and organizations who want to do things in society rather than do things in a commercial sense.
Can you talk about some of the ways in which you have given back?
One of the ways I've given back is by being an affiliate of the International Organization for Chemistry in Developing Countries. I've been vice president and treasurer of that organization for over 20 years, and I spend a lot of time trying to figure out how we, as part of a successful society in the United States, can help the developing world change their life. We spend a lot of time. We're successful occasionally, but not uniformly successful. It reminds me of our former president, Jimmy Carter, who spends a lot of his time now trying to give to society. I've been fortunate in part of my life has always been associated and affiliated with interesting, highly intelligent individuals. And that has been a wonderful part of my life that I've had the pleasure of knowing intimately people like Bob Woodward, like Linus Pauling, like John Murray Lane, and others, as well as those people more devoted to the industrial life, such as Jim Land and Jack Dreyfuss. So I've been fortunate. I've given back in various ways by working for organizations, but also by trying to create new organizations. I use some of the money I have to develop a small foundation, a family foundation. And that has been able to give away grants to certain projects I'm interested in, and recently we're in the process of converting this family foundation into a larger entity, which the National Academy of Sciences will assume, and this will be part of the National Academy of Sciences work, and will help the National Academy.
What will the nature of that entity be?
Well, as I've gotten older, it's been clear to me that not only developing countries require activities, but younger people should be exposed to cultural and scientific activities that they normally don't get. And so this work with the National, with this conversion of our foundation into an endowment at the National Academy of Sciences, will allow us to emphasize working, teaching, showing younger people that science is important to society. Mm-hmm. And what we hope to do is make very useful small television bits, say 5 minutes or so, that can interest today's youth in thinking about a future in the scientific world. Mm-hmm. So that's my latest project. It's not complete yet, but we're in the midst of negotiations to terminate our foundation and to give it to the National Academy of Sciences. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So and I still maintain, in addition to these kind of activities, I maintain my interest in making new products. Oh, it was my original interest in that, making new products. But now, I mentioned I've been affiliated with a small biotechnical company now called Ananta Ananta, he was trying to make certain new products. I'm associated with a small non-profit organization that's trying to solve the huge problem of AIDS by trying to prepare a satisfactory vaccine for AIDS. So I keep myself busy in not only thinking about these things, but actually doing some of them.
Yes. Well, you've certainly been remarkable in pursuing really three tracks, because there's the industrial, there's the academic, and there's the public service.
That's right, you said it. And I've been very fortunate. I really feel I'm fortunate. In things I've not been fortunate about is having a satisfactory relationship to my original preacher. I don't feel we have yet reached the satisfactory relationship, or will we?